conference, A Theology of Literature, the Bible as Revelation in the Tradition of the Humanities, published by Cascade Books just last month. And we have another one called Secular Scriptures, Modern Theological Poetics in the Wake of Dante, which was published in 2016. He also has books relating to the apophatic tradition of language. And as a comparativist, has works which relate to literature from other cultures apart from the European. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor William Franke for a talk entitled, I haven't got the exact words.
Poetry and Prophecy.
Proetius Prophecy from Anthropological Origins to Postmodern Apocalypses. Thank you.
Venue, which has certainly lent its aura of enchantment to our conference. I took a degree in philosophy and theology here 37 years ago, and like no other place that I know in the modern world, Oxford still has all the magic that it had at that time. It has really been a great pleasure. Now, it feels like we're at the end, but I don't intend to let us off easy, actually. One more effort. It might seem as if I'm trying to recapitulate the entire conference from Empedocles to Paul Celan. A lot of what's been talked about over all these days is condensed somewhere in what I want to present to you now. So, I beg your indulgence here and ask for your effort. My purpose, in some sense, is to instill an acute sense of what is at stake in poetry today and in any age, of what constitutes its universal value and highest calling. And this I esteem to be nothing less than prophetic revelation of theological truth, or more broadly expressed, disclosure of the deepest meaning of life and being in history as a whole. This has been poetry's vocation since time immemorial. It could and perhaps should still hold true, even in our techno-fetishistic times of spectacular forgetting of our source and origin, and of the poetry whose very reason for being is the sounding of that enigma. To this end, I propose a panoramic vision of poetry, beginning from its anthropological origins in orgiastic rites, religious cults, and sacred dance, as well as in divination, magic spells, and incantations. The end point of this trajectory is the postmodern apocalypse of poetry that witnesses to the obliteration of fixed and stable meaning in indeterminacy. In this apotheosis, the meaning of poetry expands to infinity and explodes, or implodes. As determinate meaning collapses, however, a plenum of sheer presence or absolute being in the incarnate word is free to emerge into its own. This apocalyptic event gives rise to reflection. It is the culmination of the history of poetry as one of increasing self-reflection. Such an historical reflection passes through the speculations of Plato and Longinus, Renaissance and Baroque treatises on rhetoric, romantic defenses of poetry, modernist poetic manifestos, and more. These are all different angles of approach that can illuminate poetry's high prophetic calling. Now, I think a place to begin is with the word, the Latin word vates for prophet and indistinguishably for poet, the two overlap and interpenetrate, they completely coalesce in many of their functions and modalities. The same goes for the Sanskrit word kavi, and although it's not necessarily cognate, it sounds that way. Navi in Hebrew has the same connotation. It's the word for prophet. But I think the literal meaning is to bubble forth, is from a fountain, which suggests the fecundity of poetic imagination and creativity, such as is manifest in Amos and Isaiah, Elijah, Ezekiel, producing parables, proverbs, and even love songs. So in primordial cultures worldwide, with only minimal social stratification and differentiation of roles, long before any mantles as either prophet or poet can be donned and identified, a figure like that of the shaman, or even the wizard, Merlin, amalgamates such functions and offices. These figures are emblematic of a certain undecidability between religious revelation and poetic invention or creativity. And of course, in modern cultures, then, with their highly differentiated social roles, theological revelation and poetry are typically seen as distinct and even become opposed to each other in many ways. But I think we still need to try and understand them as reciprocal and symbiotic in their origins, aims, and functions. Throughout history, the deepest intents of literary and religious practices remain inseparable from each other in their myriad manifestations within our cultural traditions and institutions. Thus, they stand to be illuminated by such a juxtaposition of the revelatory and the rhetorical. Poetry and prophecy together comprise the common matrix of some of the oldest and most fundamental modes of expression of humanity across cultures. The primary source texts of religion across traditions, the Bible, the Quran, the Confucian classics, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, these are all works of insuperable literary genius, as well as being the sources of religion. Poetic form is equally crucial to the great variety of mythopoetic and ritualistic works in folk epics, in national legends, the West African by Yajida, the American Indian Navajo, creation myth, Dine Bana. Now moving in the other direction, individual works by creative poets also become primary sources for awakening spiritual awareness and cultivating religious sensibilities. The epic tradition, Homer, Virgil, the Middle Ages, Bernard Silvestris, Alain de Lille, Dante, Milton, all of them make religious revelation explicitly their business. I think the most ambitious poetry is by its very nature religious in the sense of trying to tie all things together, religare. This still holds true, I want to suggest, even in the famously accursed French poet Maudit, particularly Baudelaire and Beau Verlaine, among the founding figures of modern lyric tradition. Poetic claims and tones continue to be asserted in the 20th century avant-garde manifestos of Futurism, Marinetti and Dadaism, Hugo Ball, and Stefan Georg's modernist Religion of Art, as declared particularly in his manifesto poem, Die Dichter in Zeiten der Viren. T.S. Eliot's Wasteland is spoken by Tiresias the prophet. Hugo von Hofmannsthal's attempt to create a spiritual nation through writing, the Schriften als geistiger Raum der Nation. Of course, this goes on, and you make your own list. The general point here is that poetry, both sacred and profane, demands to be understood as called forth by some higher agency than that of the poets themselves. Poets are the intimates of the gods. Orpheus is given his lyre and taught to play it by Apollo. There's some sort of a heavenly inspiration, or perhaps madness, with a higher transcendent source of consciousness. And yet poetry is also generally deemed to be a free creative production of human beings, whether it's choral and collective in nature or a highly personal form of lyric self-expression. The artistry of language as poiesis is crucial as well to this hybrid of poetry and prophecy that I'm trying to describe, the self-conscious crafting of the work, and even technical means from the lyre to the electric guitar have been employed to facilitate the visitation of the gods in Apollonian or Dionysian guises. And I do think that we have to take seriously rock concerts as festival events, releasing the energies that put people in contact with an ecstatic reality. So that's part of this history. Texts explicitly claiming to deliver divine revelations have generally been highly and even consummately poetic works. The Quranic Surah, the Vedic Sruti, Buddhist Sutras, along with the sacred scriptures of many other religions. And conversely, then the highest and most sublime works of poets. It's these two registers of meaning and expression that in principle belong to different categories and even to disparate spheres of reality, the human and the divine, that come together and provoke critical reflection. I think we need to be able to shift our focus flexibly back and forth from religious revelation to poetic creation, from poetic invention to theological disclosure. Poetic form is indisputably a crucial aspect of theological revelation. It's frequently ensconced in myth or imaginative narrative and is embellished with ornamental rhetoric, musical meters, lyrical flourishes, and emotional transports. We find all of that in the source text that I've mentioned, under the sign of inspiration, and that word straddles both the religious and the aesthetic semantic registers. I think this is really at the heart of the entire conference, the idea that the divine is revealed in and through the power and the event of the poetic word. Religious revelation proves to be an inextricably linguistic event. Now, the reflections that I want to offer you consider the synergism between poetic expression and religious revelation. On the one hand, poetry has its origins in sacred rites and is best understood as originally a form of religious practice and expression. But through a process of secularization, songs and stories and other imaginative types of composition become detached from their originally religious context, such as festivals, where they are employed in ritual performance. They come to be recited in profane settings and are then transmitted as autonomous works and as objects of appreciation for their aesthetic value. This is clearly the case with mythopoetic works of Greece and with the Vedic myths and narratives of India. Poetry emerges as an art from originally cultic employments. Just as, in moving the other direction, then poets, in the wake of Dante, I would suggest, deliberately reverse this process, and they aim to turn their poetic creations back into a form of ritual expression and divine revelation, or at least a supranormal perception and preternatural visionary awareness. They do so increasingly from the midst of the secularized cultures of the modern world. Poetic form, as it takes shape in rhythm with its hypnotic cadences and rhyme or parallel verse structure, belongs to the earliest testimonies of human expression in most cultures. It's traceable to the sacred origins and cult practices of music and dance. Think about the very vocabulary for prosody, the foot of a verse of poetry. That is a dancing foot
And the verse itself, versus, the turning, is part of a sacred choreography as well. This was suggested by Nietzsche in The Birth of Tragedy, out of the spirit of music. It cost him his chair in philology and perhaps even his sanity. It was strongly rejected by the philological establishment of the time. And yet, it proves to be true, and still, I think, is being discovered more and more in its power. The cultic origins here of poetry and literature, he's talking about Attic tragedy, but I think it can be generalized far beyond that. Now, it's also this cultic aspect, I believe, of poetry combined with revelation that enables pagan culture to be taken up into Christian tradition. The oracle at Delphi, with its Pythia or priestess of Apollo, as well as the sibyls at various sites in the ancient world, like Cumae, delivered their prophecies typically in hexameter verses. Christian writers adopted these sources of oracular revelation as pagan precedents for the prophetic revelations of the Bible. Such ancient oracles were implicitly baptized early on in works by classical Christian poets, Lactantius, Prudentius. Later on in the Renaissance, one still finds the five sibyls of the ancient world on the vault of the Sistine Chapel, alternating with the Hebrew prophets as they look towards the last judgment. They really are taken on board, even St. Augustine, with all of his theological rigor against the ancient world, recognizes the sibyls. There are massive infusions of prophetic lore from Hellenism into Christianity. Ephrem, the Syrian hymnographer, the Cappadocian fathers, the Greek patristic rhetoricians. I think it's the fact that these were poetic works that enabled them to be brought along when pagan religious cult was condemned. Nevertheless, one could salvage these poetic predecessors. And it comes to focus on Virgil, of course, as the central figure of the pagan poet, thanks largely to Dante, but long before Dante, he was recognized. The fourth eclogue, right, the messianic prophecy taken as such by medieval theologians. There's also, in the 4th century, this Christian cento composed by Faltona Prova that assembles fragments from Virgil in such a way as to make them retell the biblical narrative from creation to flood, followed by the gospel story. All of that was in Virgil already, according to this hermeneutic, which is fundamental to the whole Christian tradition through Dante. And medieval dream visions, Pearl, Piers Plowman, even Chaucer, incorporate the same kind of a hybrid classical and Christian inspiration for their otherworldly apocalyptic visions. But this is all a literary tradition, and I really want to widen our focus even more to consider the background in magic and divination before we have literary testimonies. Although, of course, we always rely on literary testimonies like the Merseburger Zaubersprüche. I think it's maybe 9th century in Old High German. Gives us these incantations, which were certainly at the origin of German literature in this case. The common song comes from charm. Enchantment is a kind of chante, canere. Poetry is to be understood as originally a sort of musical charming or word magic. I think we have vestiges of this still in even the nonsense verse of children in authors like Lewis Carroll, Edward Lear, E.E. Cummings. And even the child magician's hocus pocus, right, is a reminiscence of hoc est corpus meum. these ancient religious rites still live on in our poetry. This forgotten prehistory of poetry is still echoing. Now, poetry makes it possible for us to think and feel in correspondence with an unknown and unspecified surreality created by negation in language and through the infinities opened up by indeterminacies in the employment of words. And that a lot of nonsense poetry summons that up to mind. It's this indeterminacy of poetic language that has been underscored especially by postmodern criticism and theory. Now, even in our post-magic world, in our secularized world today, we have some sense of what Levi Strauss calls the l'efficacité du symbolique, the efficacy of symbols, or Freud calls die Allmacht der Gedanken, the omnipotence of thought. This is very often invoked by poets, at least in a subjective sense. It can be real for our experience as human beings. We pretend. The lyrical verses, optatives, and apostrophes still work their beneficent or maleficent effects just by pretending to induce things in the outer world to comply with human wishes. Things can be made to conform at least to the intentional representations of an inner world. Lyrical forms, for example, through their use of apostrophe, even apart from and subsequent to their pragmatic application in cultic and religious rites, retain, in vestigial guise, their original character as magical formulas used with an intention to symbolically transfigure and thereby to transmute the real. This can be made more plausible for modern readers by identification of the spiritual powers invoked with the poet's own agency. Shelley implores the Wild West wind to make me thy lyre, even as the forest is. His words become the embodiment of the spirit he invokes and enjoins. Be thou spirit fierce, my spirit. Be thou me, impetuous one, addressing the Wild West wind. Drive my dead thoughts over the universe like withered leaves to quicken a new birth. And by the incantation of this verse, scatter as from an unextinguished hearth, ashes and sparks, my words among mankind. Be through my lips to unawakened earth the trumpet of a prophecy. The poetic word has a tremendous power to reshape and revolutionize at least our human world. This power can still be considered magical, especially in its relation to the unknown, its capacity to evoke the unknown and surreal. Even in post-romantic and highly disenchanted times, poetry persists in remaking the world through acts of linguistic magic and sorcery. For example, Rimbaud, les voyelles. There's a verbal alchemy that many poets follow in. Rimbaud, some of them. Or Rainer Maria Rilke, taking inspiration from the mystery cult figure Orpheus as prophet and as the forefather of his poetry. In one loosely cohesive lineage, romantic to surrealist poets were wont to practice poetry as a kind of conjuring of the unknown. And this is du Baudelaire au surrealisme. Now, these features of poetry are vestiges and reminders that in their most remote origins, poetic compositions were integral to cultic practices of singing and dance. They're dedicated to the gods and offered in prayer, typically as appeasement or in pleading for some kind of favored treatment or protection. Festivals, for example, the Pythian Games, held in honor of Apollo every 8 years under Mount Parnassus, and celebrating the victors in athletic contests, were ways of seeking to establish fellowship with the gods. And even speaking in the gods' own voices, Of course, when we take this to be metaphorical, Vico enables us to understand all of our language, actually, as metaphorical in its origins. His poetic logic and poetic metaphysics, I consider to be very helpful for understanding poetry as a divine art, ars divina. And this is really the tradition from Dante to Vico that enables us to see how poetry comes to found and ground a comprehensive cosmic knowledge of philosophia perennis and a theologia mundi that far surpasses wisdom and importance the merely rational understanding of logical truths. And of course, there are many forms of Gnosticism, from Valentinus to Jakob Boehme, that also, I think, pervade this kind of a supernatural knowledge through poetry. But what I really want to focus on is the epic tradition. This has been a background for understanding what is really happening in the epic tradition of poetic prophecy. The term revelation itself, I think we have to understand somewhat more broadly than strictly in the so-called revealed religions. It embraces philosophical and artistic phenomenologies of revealment. There's a kind of revelation in, or disclosure, or illumination in our poetic traditions. And prophecy, as well, as has been noted repeatedly in this conference, is not really only about foreseeing the future, but rather seeing deeply into the overall meaning of history and the cosmos. And you know, the prophet is the one who speaks for God. Now, the Christian epic tradition, which I am going to turn to here, is based in many ways on Virgil. I think I should say just a word about Virgil's type of prophecy, which in many ways is analogous to Christian typology or to typology in the Bible. Because it's when Aeneas receives the prophetic revelation of the future, of what's going to happen as a result of his mission to found a new civilization, right, moving from Troy, Traslatio Imperii, to Rome. The revelation is really of Roman history for Virgil, for Caesar Augustus, but it's presented to Aeneas as a future to be accomplished. This is the way in which prophecy enters into the present with an appeal. It's not saying simply what is going to happen objectively. It is imploring and enjoining the agents of current history to act worthily of their forebears. In this case, Aeneas is the archetype to be imitated by Caesar Augustus. In order to realize this dream of Rome, is Roman history going to be the bloodbath, right, leading to senselessness, or is it going to be the triumph of universal peace under the Pax Romana? That is still weighing in the balance. It's still to be determined. And prophecy is really about catapulting us into action. Right? It takes place in this dimension of time where past, present, and future are open to communicate with each other. We have to reactualize the past by reaching forward, anticipating the future, making it real now. That's crucial now to the Christian prophetic poetry that Dante inaugurates and passes on to Milton and Blake.
And what I really want to focus on here is the German speculative tradition from Klopstock to Hölderlin to Novalis and some other German romantics as the deepest theoretical probing of prophetic poetic discourse. In this lineage, bringing together biblical with classical epic tradition, the work of Friedrich Gottlieb Klopstock, we're in the 18th century here, is seminal. Klopstock's epic poetic work, Der Messiah, together with his five religious odes or hymns and his reflections in his theoretical texts, offer invaluable insights into the nature and purpose, as well as the means of poetry as an instrument of prophecy. They are foundational for another major axis of prophetic poetry passing through Hölderlin and Novalis, Rilke, Stefan Georg. Klopstock explores in detailed aesthetic reflections the ways in which poetry can become the vehicle of theological revelation. The phenomenology of the negative experience of incommensurability, of not being adequate to the experience of God, or more exactly, the experience of God's difference from us, figures prominently in Klopstock's understanding of the aesthetics of the sublime as what alone enables us authentically to encounter God and to communicate something of this ineffable experience. For Klopstock, philosophical reasoning about God is far too subject to the illusion that God is like us and can be understood by our intellectual powers and principles. The prophet, more than the philosopher, is predisposed to ecstasy in the presence of the mysterium tremendum to experience the radical difference of the divine from the human subject. Precisely this experience is what moves prophecy beyond any rational power of control over itself. It is especially the limits of expression with the dumb marvel of astonishment, staunen, that bears witness to our infinite bottomless inferiority, aller tiefsten Unterwerfung, with respect to the divine with which we can connect only by grace. Klopstock understands art as the highest expression of life and as the best way for us to think about God. He emphasizes how our language is too weak and deficient to express what the whole soul feels in its brush with divine power. This negative experience of helplessness to express nevertheless overflows in feelings of love, rapture, blessedness, and unshakable faith and trust. Like Dante, in the Paradiso, with its all-pervasive ineffability topos, Klopstock, most intensively in his lyrical odes, employs the apophatic expression of human and linguistic impotence as a method of elevating the soul to the vision of God. Now, in the work of Friedrich Hölderlin, such theoretical reflection on poetry becomes even more integral to the poetry itself and eventually subverts the poetic enterprise, rendering it no longer possible. The self-reflexivity of the Enlightenment subject as the highest pinnacle of knowledge, reflected in the Kantian transcendental unity of apperception, emerges as in principle the ground for prophetic revelation. The pure intellectual intuition, a la Spinoza, that affords knowledge of the whole, and that was given up as lost by Hegel in his pursuit of a totally conceptual knowledge, cannot be realized theoretically or morally, since it presupposes absolute pre-reflexive unity. Such unity is not compatible with the subject-object structure of conceptual knowing and goal-directed acting, but it can be won back, according to Hölderlin, through mythic representations in poetry. This happens aesthetically through the course of history by progressive intuition of the beautiful. Beauty represents the infinite whole of being. Schelling's philosophies of mythology and of revelation move similarly towards such whole vision exceeding strictly conceptual rationality. But such vision cannot be realized abstractly
It requires poetry. Nevertheless, even in this perspective, based on Greek classicism, the difference between the human and the holy tears a rift in Hölderlin's outlook. Hölderlin's elected alter ego, Empedocles, is constrained to suicide in order to atone for the prophetic guilt he incurs, prophetische Schuld, these are Hölderlin's words, that he incurs by his revelatory speaking out. This pre-Socratic philosopher was famous in antiquity for having sprung into the volcano on Mount Etna. In Hölderlin's imagining, Empedocles speaks the unspeakable, betrays the godly, and must therefore annihilate himself. His sacrilege condemns him to suicide and dumbness, verstummen. In this vein, Hölderlin pursues the vocation of poetry to become prophetic revelation to the limits of its possibilities and even into the loss and dispersal of poetry itself. Mediating the perspective of German idealism, Hölderlin brings the pagan quest for revelation through universal nature and mind together with an understanding of prophetic poetry as an extension of revealed religion. Yet, the aporia of any attempt to represent the divine results in a renunciation of the prophetic pretensions of the poet and in an admission of the inevitably fictive nature of poetry. Poetry that pretends to be mediating the self-revelation of the divine turns out to be self-deceptive. The principle of an absolute difference between the human and the divine ultimately defeats such attempts, and Hölderlin enters consequently into the night, which leaves us only the traces of the departed gods, die Spur der entflohenen Götter. Hölderlin's hymn Patmos traces in exquisitely excruciating detail the steps and stages of this movement of poetry. It moves from the potential of realizing enlightenment ideals concretely in universal spiritual community, which is prefigured then by the disciples gathered around Christ before, shortly before the moment on Patmos, to portray poetry as being capable only of tragedy and of expressing the shipwreck of human aspirations to fullness of meaning through the self-unfolding of absolute spirit. Nonetheless, even in times of dearth, poetry still serves as a hermeneutic method for interpreting the letter of Holy Scripture. Although the realization of religious revelation in the creative poetic word proves to be only fragmentary and illusory, there's still here a vocation for the human poet prophet, specifically for German song, Deutsches Gesang, in the interpretation of the already existing record, the Bible, of the incarnation of God in Jesus. Hölderlin thus attempts dialectically to turn the loss of the physical presence of God in Christ among his disciples into a positive and productive form of anamnesis. St. John, who on the island of Patmos, through visionary channels and modalities, remembers Jesus' life on earth and his going away, wrestles with the paradoxical nearness and yet ungraspable nature of the divine. Nah ist und schwer zu fassen, der Gott. God is near and yet difficult to grasp. And I think that this is the subject's transcendental unity of apperception. It's near. It underlies every cognition of mind, and yet it cannot grasp it, because then you split subject and object, and you've lost the wholeness and unity. From its opening lines, Patmos is a hymn about the loss of this presence among us of the holy. In the end, Hölderlin's masterpiece retreats to a position of only following up the traces of divinity that can still be discerned and that are disseminated through words. As in Jesus' parable of the sower, which the hymn invokes, only this dispersion itself conveys any glimmer of hope for the future. Hölderlin's transcendental philosophical reflection on poetry as revelation and the impasse he encounters is pursued to a different result by his romantic contemporaries and successors. The dialectical self-negation of poetry as prophecy, in which Hölderlin's aspirations met with defeat, is given a more affirmative and triumphant spin in romantic circles notably by Novalis and Friedrich Schlegel in some ways. For them, although there is no direct or adequate language for expressing the transcendent, still indirectly, language used in formally innovative and creative ways can effectively symbolize and communicate something that transcends representation. Now, before going on to them, and I do want to discuss them, I wish once again to broaden the scope for a moment so as to consider prophetic poetry in our secular era more generally. The topos of poetry as prophetic revelation remains still operative, even in very self-consciously and militantly modern poets, from Arthur Rimbaud to Allen Ginsberg, where the rapture and ecstasy of poetic madness replaces religious motives of devotion and yet still asserts itself as true revelation of the pathos of the human condition and of the enigma of the universe. Poetry becomes the privileged locus of a kind of return of the gods in secularized guises. The return of the pagan gods occurs in a purely aesthetic register with Baudelaire, Rimbaud, Verlaine, Valéry, having been reduced since the Renaissance to the cramped rubrics of rhetoric. The gods come out into a nomadic kind of exile as fugitive presences in the modern metropolis. They have exited from the dogmas of the Quran, the Vedas, and the Bible, and now, full of rage, are on campaign, plein de rage, tous les dieux sont sortis en campagne, according to Verlaine's sonnet, Les Dieux, as signaled by Baudelaire's Flowers of Evil, and more specifically and acutely by his essay, L'École païenne. This movement is an emancipation of the aesthetic, which is no longer subject to the good and the true, as for former ages of theological and metaphysical theories of art. Nietzsche had proclaimed that the only justification of the world is aesthetic. We enter into the era of the autonomy of the aesthetic, vulgarly expressed art for art's sake, but nonetheless, a revolution consisting in a profound transvaluation of all values. The passion for art and for pure form, avowed already by Baudelaire, becomes measureless and uncontrollable. The abyss opens and the nothing appears, that's Valéry, since there is now no foundation for the pure experience of poetry and its unlimited aesthetic intensity and freedom. The gods have evaded the places of the cult and their niches on temples and cathedrals by being transfused into literature, which becomes itself absolute as the place of their continued appearing in modern times. The gods can now be found in the unconscious, for example, in the elusive, indistinct murmurings, half apprehended, in the interstices between nature and culture, between sound and sense, between bodily sensation and linguistic signification, between memory and forgetting. Such are the Nachtgeräusche, the night sounds of Conrad Myers. In its most secularized forms, the voices of the muses come to be heard in the promptings of the unconscious, and even, I want to suggest, in the miracles of telecommunications throughout the ensuing century that give rise to a kind of omnipresence in a kingdom come, a virtual hyper-reality, a realized eschatology of the purely positive with no transcendence nor any holy other in two ways. The veil of mystery over poetic creation might seem to have been completely torn away. However, there's also a more reverent reading of Hölderlin's legacy, one that remains in awe of religion and recognizes its grounds in unknowing. In this post-secular movement, poetic interpretation enacts prophetic revelation in a negative theological register. For the connecting tissue to these eventually postmodern forms of poetic prophecy, we have to return to explicit thematic employments of an address from divinity that can be traced in the development along a central axis from Klopstock to Hölderlin and beyond to Romantic poets. Klopstock prepares the way for distinctly the modern lineage of prophetic poets by configuring the lyric poet, the lyric subject's feelings and thoughts, its transports, prayers, and visions, as representatives and messengers of God, and as theological utterances. This is fundamentally the strategy discovered already by Dante, especially in his Paradiso. The declaration of the ineffability of his theme becomes negatively the only authentic form of expression of the direct experience of the divine vision. Klopstock extends the vocation of the prophetic poet chiefly affirmed in his epic Dermacia in the direction of a lyrical vocation that prefigures more closely the destiny of poetry as revelation in the later modern period, notably in his odes, The Vision of God. This lyrical vein opens a dimension of inner subjective experience as the ground of revelation. This subjective dimension will be theorized and absolutized by idealist philosophy culminating in Fichte and will be exploited to the full by romantic prophetic poets. However, certain theses of idealism are reversed in their poetic application. Novalis contradicts Fichte's positioning of the I as founding act at the origin of the world by admitting self-critically that the I that posits itself is a fiction, and even a falsehood. Any representation is partial and distorting. Only in negating itself can a truly transcendental unity of apperception be indicated, hence as not I. This negative self-reflection, reflecting on the nullity of first-order Fichtean immediate reflection of self, is a way of expressing the total ground of existence. This is what Novalis, in his Hymnen an die Nacht, does under the figurative cover of night. The reality tapped into is neither human nor divine, but the dark ground, and at the same time, the luminous source of both. It can be felt, but not known. This feeling of oneself, Selbstgefühl, because it is, I believe, the transcendental unity of apperception that is the source here of prophecy. In some ways, this represents a kind of unsurpassable limit. A kind of dead end for communication. Where can prophetic poetry go from here? Well, one answer comes in the shape of Walt Whitman, who carries a romantic understanding of prophetic poetry forward to the New World and recasts it as opening broad new vistas in a revolutionary democratic spirit. Whitman's embodied and relational subject reopens speculative subjectivity to realize a limitless unknowing in incarnate form. Whitman's Song of Myself comes from beyond self-reflection. It comes as an unmediated manifestation of cosmic consciousness of self. The suggestion of Whitman is that the radical democratic equality of all with all, even in its seeming to contradict the transcendence of the one, is itself the means of transcending all limits between things. I do not call one greater and one smaller. That which fills its period and place is equal to any. And in fact, I think equality and prophecy do go together. I was sorry we didn't have more time to discuss that yesterday. Social equality, in many ways, is the product of prophetic vision by envisioning that absolute transcendent difference in monotheistic religion with God that levels all other differences, which are merely human, right? As Isaiah says, the mountains shall be as the valleys. This egalitarian ethos is very much a part of the prophetic vision early on in the prophets, but then also, I think, in latter day, in some of its latter day reincarnations in Whitman. Rather than transcending the direction of the absolutely other, the other is one, the democratic gospel of universal equality frees beings in all directions to be just what they are, and potentially to be in relation to all others without any limitation. Each being can itself expand into the absolute relatedness of all with all, dissolving all ontological boundaries. Whitman's visionary poetry conceives of America as a radical rupture with previous world history as a whole. And yet the categories of eschatology and salvation history that he deploys in his prophetic declarations carry forward the characteristic literary forms generated by this very history. He even includes reenactment of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ in his self-understanding of his own prophetic calling. Yet he appropriates these figures as mythic archetypes for the cultural historical projection of his own lyrical biographical self as self-consciously sacred in its own infinite self-unfolding. This involves especially an eroticization of the Christ event and its salvific effects. Whitman's autoeroticism, for instance, in the masturbatory scene in section 5 of Song of Myself, turns into a primordial sacred rite of cosmic mysticism. It is framed by and issues in, moreover, a political messianism that envisages America as the culmination of an evolutionary process that coincides with a biblically derived salvation history. Whitman's prophetic word in this matter moves beyond the aesthetic realm and steps out beyond the bindings of the book, of the prophetic text, to become an agent effective in history, a leading participant in shaping the future. For Whitman, not unlike Herder and Haman, for whom poetry is the mother tongue of the human race, the Bible is the model of the poetry that is the authentic voice of the people. Here a self-reflexive moment is still key, yet now as integrated with the body, with a corporal authorial presence. Whitman stages the crucifixion and the resurrection as quintessentially self-reflective moments in which, quote, I discover myself through detachment and self-negation. He wishes that I could look with a separate look on my own crucifixion and bloody crowning. This is from Song of Myself. This Christic vocation embodied in self-sacrificial love that extends to others by nursing them even on the point of death entails reflection on the poet's resurrection in and as a textual body and even in and as the reader. Whitman's final poem, So Long, which appears as the envoi of Leaves of Grass, effects a future-oriented opening of his oeuvre to a new or further creative phase in the hands and body of the reader, whose breath and pulse are felt as the poet's own. The address to the reader is crucial to the prophetic poetic tradition that can be reconstructed around Dante at the historical center of this mode of Christian epic poetry as it stretches from the Bible to James Joyce. I read Finnegan's Wake as the culmination of this Christian epic tradition. Some poetry in Apocalypse. Whitman oversteps the boundaries of the book, offering the best of himself in love to whoever will have him, cajoling camarado. This is no book. Who touches this touches a man. Is it night? Are we here together alone? It is I you hold, and who holds you? I spring from the pages into your arms. Decease calls me forth. Right? Because he's dead, he's there, I suppose. That's the real Whitman in the present. of reading. Well, decease is a very interesting word, meaning much more than that. In transcending the frame of the literary altogether, in uniting and even fusing with his reader in projected face-to-face encounter, Whitman represents the spirit of prophetic poetry fully incarnate in a secularized modern world. His Song of Myself carries self-reflection beyond consciousness to the body in all its universal relations. This is a Christic body sacrificed for the salvation of all readers anyway. In the prefaces to Leaves of Grass and in Democratic Vistas, his theoretical essay, Whitman takes over the traditional vocabulary of prophetic poetry in order to outline a realized eschatology of the kingdom of God on earth in America as the restoration of the paradise that was lost through the old world's inveterate forms of enslavement and hegemony. In these theoretical discussions, but most of all in his poetry, Whitman forges a future-oriented religion of democracy. This shibboleth is used as practically synonymous with America and exudes a virtually unlimited optimism with regard to human progress and perfectibility. In some respects, Whitman represents also a radical break with the prophetic tradition in its self-reflective, self-critical orientation. He substitutes in its place a new national identity that is oriented wholly to the future and bent on exiting from the past rather than on recapitulating it in bono and thereby redeeming it. In Whitman, the transcendent dimension of divine action and of a metaphysical other world are affirmed, yet only together and along with the imminent presence of divinity operating in the temporal reality of human beings. It is manifest particularly in the life of their bodies, an orientation to the future as the direction of concretely achievable transcendence, moreover, takes on an absoluteness and sufficiency of its own. This is a fully secularized or worldly incarnate type of prophetic vision. It is conflated in Whitman with a visionary politics of the nation, of America as the nation of nations, realizing the dreams of humanity as a whole. Almost there. Thus, the all-important difference of transcendent divinity that was the premise of the prophetic poetic tradition is not denied, but it is completely conflated with a total immanence that in merely logical terms contradicts it. And Whitman's the one who says, I contradict myself very well. I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. This constitutes a significant turn and reconfiguration of the figure of prophetic prophetism. But it is also understandable as an inevitable outgrowth and destination of this religious poetic genre in the emerging modern world. Whitman's reenactment of the vocation of the prophet can even be understood as pointing prophetically in the direction of the explosion of lyric subjectivity that was to come about in our own ultra-modern times. The postmodern moment returns us to a trans-historical sense of poetic language as breaking out beyond the constraints of time, as touching potentially on the eternal. Suddenly it becomes possible to reawaken in mysterious new senses such pre-modern idioms that spoke or sang the notes of truth and eternity to untold generations of our forebears. This is a heritage worth cherishing and cultivating. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Franklin, for a wide sweep, a survey, a wide sweep of literature and religion and pretty well everything else as well. Thank you.
That's religion.
Does anybody have any questions or points they would like to make? Yes.
Thank you for that wonderful lecture. I'm really happy that you ended with Whitman, and I wanted to Whitman in thinking not only of his future-oriented optimism, but also in his tremendous heartbreak about the American Civil War, and then the ways that that transforms or makes him rethink prophecy. And I guess that I'm asking that in the context of, American pessimism, right? Like a way, and I'm asking about whether the prophetic mode has enough flexibility to also handle this kind of historical event. And I'm sort of thinking of the Civil War and now as maybe prophetically parallel in some way in terms of American politics.
Absolutely. No. Wonderful. As a complement to what I presented in very condensed form, I think that's essential. Leaving that out gives us a very false understanding, I think, of Whitman's prophecy, and of course of its legacy to us today, living in a heartbroken time of America and the world. That is actually essential to our prophetic understanding, and it's the brokenness of the body of Christ on the cross that is at the very origin of this kind of prophetic inspiration. In fact, it's really only through the breaking open that an authentic prophetic word, authentic prophetic word is a broken word. And that comes through in Whitman as well. I think, you know, I owe to your comment to bring that out today, because you're right, I glossed over that. It's crucial all through the tradition. It's really only in the brokenness of the human word that a space, right, the crack we read in Leonard Cohen was recited earlier, that that's how the light gets in, right, through the cracks. And without that, we're not, in an authentic mode of prophetic poetry, and you really bring it home with the Civil War in America. And you know, Whitman, his poem, when the lilacs bloomed on Lincoln, actually, the coffin of Lincoln, you know, on the train through the various cities of America, his elegy, it does actually give his whole oeuvre a kind of elegiac turn. And thank you, Jan, for reminding us that we have to hear Whitman in that register.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. You've developed an account of poetry as an experiential force in many ways for reader and writer alike. I noticed you also surveyed this pre-history of poetry, the forgotten history of poetry as inspiration. And I was thinking that this understanding of poetry is exactly what Plato has in mind in the Ion, where he dismisses the oral performance art as, dismisses the possibility of the oral performance art as something cognitive. So I was just wondering how would you position the Christian epic tradition or your experiential understanding of poetry in relation to Plato's very influential critique?
Yes. Yeah. It's an interesting critique, and Plato means it as a critique of Ion, who doesn't understand what he's saying. He's reciting Homer, he's inspired. The fact that he is inspired means that he doesn't have rational grasp and of the meaning of the words of the muse. Plato faults him for that. I think we can turn it around and see that as being the virtue of, in this case, the rhapsod is maybe that's some species of a prophet. Now, even though Plato is really speaking in the name of philosophy and really trying to install philosophy as the crowning science of all, Plato does this with his own mythic forms, with his own poetry. There's an experiential dimension to
Plato's philosophy that is conveyed by the poeticality. And in fact, that's, you know, that's how Plato's thinking really does penetrate us. There's a kind of a tension, if not a contradiction, between the, you know, the actual content, the proposition that Plato's putting forth, and what his word achieves in effect. And I think the ion is really a crux for that tension. I would cite the ion as really a source text for the concept of poetic prophecy that does come, you know, from Greeks through and, you know, mediated with biblical traditions. There's conflict and tension, but they belong together ultimately.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this wonderful overview. You got me thinking a lot. I was fascinated that you suggested that rock concerts are part of divine revelation. And I found myself wondering, as you talked so incisively about the nature of poetic form, whether when we talk about prophecy in the present age, whether the identification of poetic form precisely is necessary. That's to say, is there a prophetic voice to be heard in other forms of art? In particular, one might think these days of movies, for instance, or indeed songs, but songs are nearer to a kind of poetry. I'm wondering whether prose is capable of being prophetic, or whether it needs the kind of poetic form that you have taken us back to as we think about Vates in the beginning.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I would certainly not take poetic form in a narrow sense. There is certainly poetry in all of the arts. Painting, music are poetic. But one of the distinguishing features of prophetic poetics is that at some point form is transcended into the formless or into the absolute, which is somewhere beyond form. So there's form in all of the arts, and prose can be highly lyrical, poetic, it's oratorical. So I would see a continuum there, but it's actually in going beyond form into some sort of an evocation, an intimation of an absolute which is formless. It's just the Eastern traditions, Tao Te Ching, would insist very much on the formlessness of the Tao. At some point, we do have to, I think, look beyond form. But that leaves, you know, all of the any medium that can induce an experience of one's own ground that relates one to everyone else, to every other being related to this same ground. Who's to say what is poetic and what isn't? You know, when we look at art exhibitions today, the question, you know, is this art? What is art? But there's a search for something beyond us that nevertheless is what binds us together, what grounds us all in common. And I think that is evoked in many ways and in many different media.
Thanks very much for finishing our conference in such a wonderfully high and rich note. You mentioned everybody else, so one name that hasn't occurred, I'm just kind of a cooler. Shakespeare, he's been mentioned by anybody, and yet he's such a powerful, authoritative, prophetic presence in our culture. Do you want to throw a few words on him?
Yeah. I have to come to Shakespeare. When I was here, I did a lot of Shakespeare. That was a long time ago, and I agree with you. Certainly Milton's prophetic vocation owes everything really to Shakespeare, even more than Dante. Of course, Shakespeare is very elusive. Where's Shakespeare's voice? It's nowhere. It really is the dispersion of all the voices of humanity. And yes, I think Shakespeare is still on the horizon here. I haven't really got there yet, but I do intend to.
I think we have time for one more question.
Just following up on some of the thank you very much. Following up on some of the other comments, I'm just reminded of, I think it's from James Brass, the very famous kind of almost liturgy of lines that lead up to "Finally comes the poet, the true son of God." And the lines right before that are, "The engineer, after the engineers have done their work, after the explorers have explored as far as they can explore, after the scientists and the inventors have done their work, finally comes the true Son of God singing his songs." And I'm just wondering, we had a question about poetry versus prose. That to me is an interesting juxtaposition. And I'm questioning whether the poet there, the true Son of God, what is the inference? More true than those listed just before? Are the culmination of that grouping? What the relationship might be, because he's dealing with engineering and science and in some very different disciplines.
Yes. Yeah. Any claim to being the true revelation, now the true Son of God, has to be heard as representative, as exemplary, not as exclusive, not over and against the others. But there are certain individuals that become the conduits that enable us to see into this deeper metaphysical dimension. There, of course, in the Christian religion, God takes the initiative to come himself in person, and yet everyone encounters Christ in someone different. So that I think every profession, every channel, every different being can be a channel to this true revelation. This is the spirit of the prophecy, as I elicited here from Whitman and his egalitarianism, but it's also there in the Bible itself. And paradoxically, there is the focus on the one true Son of God. And yet, that is an opening to all to become the witness, to become themselves, really, the channel of redemption. So you're right to point to a kind of a logical paradox, and I think it's the prophetic insight that enables us to somehow surmount the apparent division and exclusiveness in this vision, as it's been transmitted, I think, through the ages. Everything communicates with everything else. It's all one body, right? Saint Paul, every part is everybody's essential, really, is every other.
Thank you. I think that brings us to the end of the time that we have for this lecture. So it remains just for me to thank Professor.